7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie just had a little bit of key lime pie before we started.
Well, we have Joe's here.
Well, Jerry Seinfeld has a joke about human fears. It goes something like this. A study finds that people fear public speaking more than they fear death. Think of it. They prefer to occupy the casket than give the eulogy. We'll discuss our fears with someone who knows all about them. She's Patty Chang Anker. She's the author of Some Nerve, Lessons Learned While Becoming Brave. And she joins us from Hastings on Hudson, New York. Welcome.
Hi there. I wish that Hastings-on-Hudson had, its own pie. That would make me happy.
Yeah, it should. It should. It sounds like it should. So, hi, Patty. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there. I'm so glad to be here.
Hi. Tell us a little bit about your background as the child of Chinese immigrants. Were your parents, and then you, do you think, risk-averse for good reason?
Oh, you know, I think so. I think that being the child of immigrants, very often immigrants have had to overcome a great deal of hardship and difficulty to make their way here. And it is often all about survival, you know, and so that can make you weigh very carefully decisions that you make and where you put your time and energy. And you're in this mode of feeling threatened from different areas. So I think I did get a lot of that input growing up that, you know, you want to be careful with what you do. And especially coming from cultures where there's been war, there's been dislocation, these fears are very real, you know, that bad things happen in the world. And so in order to try to protect yourself and to protect your family from it, those messages can be very deep and impactful. I think that the issue for me growing up Asian American is that to have those fears dictate my decision making when my reality wasn't the same as my parents, that's where it became something where it was starting to inhibit my life. It was making me live a smaller life than I needed to. And I think that is where I realized that I needed to make a shift in my life if I was going to be able to make the most out of it.
You talk about the fear of being a, quote, beginner. I suppose that's common with most everyone. Nobody likes to be the beginner.
I feel like this feeling of being out of your element and not knowing how it's going to turn out, especially if you're raised to succeed, is a very difficult space to be in. I think a lot of Asian Americans are groomed for success. And that can make you avoid situations where you're not sure whether you're going to be any good at it. For children, they're beginners at everything, right? And so when I started raising my own kids and realizing that I wanted them to be able to take those beginner steps and intermediate steps, and then if they wanted to, those advanced steps, but I wanted them to do it with a sense of possibility and of joy rather than with this fear that what if I fail, what if it doesn't turn out well.
You know, when did you give that TED Talk at Hunter?
Oh, very recently.
That's what I thought. So I listened to that talk, and I was moved by your honesty and your sense of humor. But you said in giving that talk, you had never been so nervous in your life. Why?
So my high school was a very intensely competitive high school. We were all being groomed there for advanced degrees and for changing the world. Like, that was really the expectation that we had going in. And something about going back to that space where, you know, we were our SAT number, you were your GPA, like there was that was a measure by which, you know, we felt our self-worth. You know, when you say that Jerry Seinfeld said, like, people would rather die than be embarrassed in public, which is basically the fear that comes from public speaking, that's what it feels like to fail. Like, to someone who is groomed to succeed, it feels like self-annihilation if you fail. There was something about going back to that space and seeing my old teachers and just remembering the responsibility that was on us to go out and change the world, I was a nervous wreck.
So how did you think you did? I think you did great.
Thank you so much. You know, the public speaking is a big part of my book because it is such a prevalent fear. I mean, there are Toastmasters chapters all around the world. I think across cultures, people have this fear of standing up there looking like an idiot. So in researching it, I visited Toastmasters, I interviewed coaches, I interviewed public relations specialists, and really worked on this idea of what is the worst thing that happens if you don't look good, if you fail in front of your colleagues, how can you talk yourself through the situation? And so I had to bring all of that to bear. So, like, in this real life, in vivo experience, getting up on that stage and feeling mm-hmm. the dry mouth and, hearing myself breathe in the microphone, I had to use all of those techniques. And I think it worked. I felt very good about being able to connect with my own story and share it with the audience. That's something that everyone says to come back to, is just connect with the reason why you're there, and then how you look is secondary. And so that's what I really tried to do.
When I was looking over your book, Patty, it reminded me that even though Bonnie and I speak to, hopefully thousands of people every day, one time friends tried to cajole me into singing karaoke, and there was no way I could have done that.
Now, why do you say that? Why is there no way you could have done that? What would have happened?
I couldn't have done it. I just couldn't have.
Could you now?
No.
Okay, he still can, Patty. What can you tell him?
I can sense a some nerve challenge coming on.
Some nerve challenge. We're going to talk about that too, because that's great.
Well, I would love. Can we talk a little bit about this karaoke thing? Because I think it's.
Oh, why did I bring this up?
No, it's good to bring. It's good. It's a good example.
You're like my friend.
Because I sing terribly. That's why.
Oh, okay. All right. And everyone who sings karaoke is a brilliant singer.
And the worst singers sing the longest songs, like American Pie or something like that.
But it's not because you're a bad singer that you're afraid. That's what Patty's getting at.
Right, because plenty of bad singers sing karaoke.
Mm-hmm.
It would be embarrassing.
That's sort of why it's there.
It would be embarrassing.
Right, yeah. So, I do three quick checks when I feel that resistance come up inside myself. And whenever I think to myself, oh, no way, I can't go there, then I sort of ask myself why. And is it a reason that is in your heart? Like, is there the idea of being embarrassed is so painful, and why is that? Does it have something to do with how you were raised? Does it have something to do with a past experience? Sometimes if you identify where that might be coming from and then put it in its place and say that happened a long time ago, or it's excruciating to be embarrassed when you're a teenager, but I'm not a teenager anymore, like I can pretty much recover from things, sometimes that helps. And then the second thing is to ask your brain, is this a logical thing for me to think. So you're a radio personality, so maybe it...
Minor.
How you're perceived is important, right, for your reputation. So if that is something serious to consider, it makes logical sense, then that's something to listen to. If it's something where, Brian Williams goes on late night all the time and cuts up and, makes fun of himself, and he's this major news anchor, so... If it's something that isn't really that big a deal, then on a logical level, you can tell yourself cognitively, okay, I need to put this in its place. I don't need to make this heavier than I need it to be. And then the other thing to weigh is just whether the benefit of doing it might outweigh any disadvantage. So it's like if you were to able to relax with your friends, show a different side to yourself, like really surprise yourself maybe by having fun, then you could accept the feeling of being uncomfortable in the moment. Does that make sense?
Yes, I just don't see Joe and fun in the same...
That is the reason to do it.
Maybe we should go to a break.
Well, first let's tell our listeners that if you have a fear or a phobia, or if there's something you want to chat with Patty Chang Enger about,
It's not kinky or anything.
You can call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email us radio@wlrn.org. And before we go to that break, Patty, I would like you to describe the first time you literally took that plunge off the diving board, that first time.
Okay, so I was 39 years old. I had never had any past success with diving, but I wanted to show my daughter, who was 8 years old at the time, and she was scared to jump off the diving board at camp. I wanted to show her that if I could do it, then really, like, seriously, mom is a total klutz, and if mom can do this, and mom, like, by definition, like, is going to look dumb. So, and if mom can look dumb, then, you know, I can survive it too. And it was terrifying, and being the nightmare that we all have, right, of being exposed in a swimsuit high up where everyone can see you shaking, you know, that is exactly what it felt like. But it was real life, you know. And I did ask myself, like, what have I gotten myself into? Why am I doing this? And I just felt convicted in that moment that I needed to do something out of character. It was completely out of character for me to put myself out there like that and to do something that did not come naturally at all because, you know, I'm Chinese American. I'm very good at reading. I'm not very good at athletic things. And I'd always counted myself out of things like that. I would just say, you know, I'm not good at that. That's not my thing. You know, you guys go ahead. And to really put myself in it, because when you're alone on that diving board in your bathing suit and you're a middle-aged woman, like, you are in it. So I did it, and I think that I was so proud. You know, like, some people didn't get it. They were like, oh, did you skydive or did you scuba dive? Like, what's the big deal of diving into a deep end? And I was like, you know what? Anywhere where we feel that boundary for ourselves and we say, I can't go there, anytime you do it and you realize that you can, you become a bigger person. And it was the most exciting, electric moment of my adult life. And it changed everything else. Everything else that followed of facing a number of my fears in succession and then helping other people face theirs, I feel like the impact of it is just unknowable. People are writing into me from all over the world saying that they're facing a fear because of reading a story connected to some nerve. And that's something where, why are we counting ourselves out of things if we could have that kind of an impact?
We're speaking with Patty Chang Enger. She is a writer and blogger, a yoga instructor, and a fear facer. And she blogs for PsychologyToday.com's anxiety section and has her own award-winning blog, Facing 40 Upside Down. The name of her book is... Her first book.
Facing 40. Wait till she's facing 60.
Her first book is a memoir, Some Nerve, Lessons Learned While Becoming Brave. Let's take that break and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Thursday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Patty Chang Enger. And she's written Some Nerve, Lessons Learned While Becoming Brave. You can join us, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. So, Patty, you talk about this Greek chorus of perpetual doubt that you carried around with you. I think we all have these voices inside our head that say we shouldn't do something, or, you know, that we're not good enough, or we're going to fail, or whatever. So how did you learn to put it to rest, or is the chorus still with you?
You know, I feel like the chorus takes a lifetime to accumulate. You know, it's like these are questioning voices that come up, and they might have been teachers, relatives, frenemies, you know, people who have populated your life and told you, you know, that didn't turn out that well, you weren't all that good at that, are you sure you want to do this? And if they've taken your whole life to accumulate, they don't go away that easily. I feel like my Greek chorus is always with me, and it's a matter of making friends with them and understanding that most of the time they mean well, and to understand whether what they're warning me about is really legit. Orifs are just being overprotective. Orifs are just being mean. You know, I think that sometimes we talk to ourselves in a way that you would never speak to your kid and say, like, you know, who do you think you are? You're no good at that. You know, forget it. You would never speak that way to a true friend, and yet we'll speak that way to ourselves. So I'll have this conversation with myself and say, okay, who here is being a little dramatic? And I will ask that person to leave. And who here is kind of sabotaging me? You know, like, I would actually like to try. I would actually like to figure out what might happen. And yeah, it might end badly, but I'm a strong enough person to be able to handle it. And it would be worse for me to just not try. And I think that's the big turn, and, you know, the mental turn that we can all take when people say, like, is it really possible to change my thoughts, my personality, my temperament? And it is, if you learn how to turn the volume down on the negative questioning voices and turn the volume up on the voices that want something new for you, you know, that want something better for you. If you allow those voices to come forward, you can change.
You know, I was thinking, I'm not a therapist, but I was thinking, even when you got on stage for the TED Talk, you were saying you were a klutz, and that's why you worried about walking up on the stage. And I was thinking, if you tell yourself that all the time, that that must have a negative effect.
Yes. And I when I say that I'm a klutz, I am really a klutz. Like, I gave myself a fat lip parallel parking my car. Like, people said, oh, you face all these fears, you know, have you injured yourself? And I injure myself every day. Like, I fell off a swing and, you know, sprained my finger. I did, like, it's... my editor was like, you are really not kidding. You know, like, they had to take out instances of my hurting myself out of the book because they were like, it's just, no one will believe you. So I have to tell myself that even though these things happen, I need to go out there anyway. So it was highly likely that I was going to trip and fall at the TED Talk, but I needed to get up there and do it anyway. And it turned out okay.
Yeah, it did. That's kind of funny. So what you're saying is, when you call yourself a klutz, you're not giving yourself negative talk. You're talking honestly to yourself.
It is. Yes, we need to be grounded in reality.
Right. Let's take a telephone call. We've got Gus. He's in Boca Raton. Are you driving on the cell phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead, Gus. It's a little hard to hear you, but go ahead.
I was listening to the program while driving, and I really appreciate it. I'm enjoying it tremendously. My situation is exactly about fear of talking in public.
What about calling talk radio?
Trying to, I don't think so. I'm doing so far okay.
Right.
Great. You're doing great.
I don't have no problem talking in one-on-one to anybody in any category or any position. But if for some reason, when I'm facing 50 people in front of me and I'm up on stage, I just kind of forget what I'm about to say. I just go black.
So what do you think, Patty?
I think that that's so common, and all of us mess up all the time in life. You know, we blank out on someone's name that we're talking to. We forget what our next thought is going to be. We say that we're going to do something, and then we actually forget to follow through on it. Like, that happens in life all the time. And yet somehow when it's in front of a group of people, it just feels exponentially worse.
Gus, we're going to let you go. Drive now and talk later.
Thank you.
Drive and listen. Thank you for calling, Gus. So why is that? That when you're in front of people, all of a sudden it's your entire reputation is on the line, and it would just be the end of the world if you stumbled or if you forgot your next point. So I recommend with public speaking, because when you are nervous, and sometimes it's hard to stop being nervous, you know, the nerves are going to come, to allow them to come and to say, okay, this feels terrible right now. I'm having difficulty breathing. my heart is palpitating. I feel like I'm going to die, but I am not going to die. And as soon as my brain realizes that, I am going to be able to find my next thought. It will be there because I still have the same brain now that I had 5 minutes ago, right? It's just, it's a little nervous. So our brains are wired to feel the fear first and then to figure out what to do. So those physical flight or fight reaction symptoms arrive. You allow them to arrive. You say, hi, how are you? You're trying to protect me. You're going to realize any moment now that I'm actually fine. And then the brain will kick in and you'll be able to find the next spot. I also think it's good to have notes. I think that there's nothing to be embarrassed about, to have an outline with you, to have notes to refer to, because it does happen. And then if you have a little prompt for yourself, you can keep going. I think to forgive yourself instantly of, you know, little mistakes that you make when you're in front of other people, because everyone understands that you're human. They make mistakes too. We're all human. So those are just quick tips. And then I really do recommend Toastmasters. I feel like it's just a great organization. You go in and really practice and get feedback right away. It's extremely helpful for people who don't get opportunities to practice normally and would never volunteer to. In Toastmasters, you are up there all the time. And then it's with the practice that you get used to feeling nervous, you get used to pushing through it, and then when you do well, you get all this great feedback, and I've seen many lives transformed through that process.
I find when I speak in public, I have anxiety before, but once I get going, then I'm all right.
Me too. I feel that way too. And so I feel like at the end of the day, we're here to connect with other people. You know, it's like we are here on this earth to make a difference in some way. And if you hold yourself back from expressing your experiences, your insights, the world is a poorer place for it. You know, so it's like if we have to suffer a little bit of discomfort and of risking something negative for ourselves and of feeling like we might look dumb, like if that's the cost of being able to relate a story that might change someone else's life, then we just have to put up with it, I think.
Patty, what's the next fear you plan on tackling? Do you have any left?
Oh, I have plenty left. I feel like the fear doesn't go away, but the ability to work through it gets much, much strengthened. And I feel like my life is a lot fuller and happier now because I don't look at things as dead ends, you know, things that I'm afraid of, that's a dead end. I don't look at that anymore. I feel like everything is a possibility. I have this ongoing fear of technology. So I'm like, I have not upgraded my iPhone.
Neither have I. I'm too afraid to do it. There are too many problems with it from what I hear.
I did. It's pretty good.
Okay.
I have this ongoing, it's like this little fear of aging. You know, I feel like a lot of my friends are going through it now. A friend said that she is considering doing belly dancing. I might do that with her.
Okay. Listen, we only have about a minute left, but before we go, I want you to tell us very quickly about the Some Nerve Challenge and about facing 40 upside down.
Okay, so it's all very good to talk about your fears, but to actually do something about it is really the best way to conquer your fear. And so I'm inviting people to declare, I will face my fear of blank by blank. And you can send it in to me on my website, which is pattychanganker.com. If you look up Some Nerve, then it'll pop up. And then we can cheer you on.
Well, you're not going to hear about me and karaoke.
Oh, I know I will.
But I may contact you, Patty.
The universe.
I may contact you, yes.
Please do. I would love that. And then we support each other because none of us needs to be alone in what we fear. There are lots of people out there who share the same fear with you or who can help you. And if you reach out, then everything changes. We help each other.
Well, we want to thank you so much. Patty Chang Anker has written a memoir, Some Nerve, Lessons Learned While Becoming Brave. And more courage to you, or more power
to
you, or something. It's been great having you. Thanks for joining us.
More nerve. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Food and Dining is next. And we return. It's today's topical occurrence, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And today is Thursday, of course. The legendary Joe's Stone Crab Restaurant started in 1913 as a Miami Beach lunch counter. It's the 100th anniversary of its opening, and joining us now is chef, author, and syndicated columnist, my friend Linda Gassenheimer. Linda, just thinking about those crabs dipped in mustard sauce, clarified butter. Oh,
I saw you just now gorging yourself. We've got a studio full of
speaking of gorging.
Yes.
You didn't do too badly either.
No, well, Linda.
Are you saying something to me?
No, Linda.
Well, think of a legendary Florida restaurant. And what comes to mind? For me, of course, it's Joe's Stone Crabs. And waiting at Joe's means two things to many of us. Of course, the long waits for a table. But another is the reputation for an excellent waiting staff. And Deanne Kaplan Lorber is the author of a book called Waiting at Joe's. And she's going to give us an inside look at what goes on there. And let's welcome Deanne. Hello, nice to have you.
Nice to be here, Linda. Thank you.
Great to have you. And also with us, Stephen Sawitz. He's Joe's chief operating officer and the great-grandson of the founder, Joe Weiss. Stephen, more than welcome. You came loaded with stone crabs.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me, and thanks for having the stone crabs, too, on the table.
It's good. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Join us. Do you have any questions or comments about Joe's stone crab, or maybe for Deanne Lorber? Call us at 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Email
is open, radio@WLRN.org. I think it's working, radio@WLRN.org.
I've got a question for Deanne.
Excuse me. Could we say hello to Fred?
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Oh, thanks.
Is Fred there?
Fred, are you there?
This is old chopped liver right here.
Yes, hey, Fred.
Joining us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker, and he's joining us by phone this time. And you can read Fred's wine suggestion for my Dinner in Minutes column in today's Miami Herald. And also, his wine column is in today's Herald. Fred, are we going to be drinking today?
We're going to figure out what kind of wine to go with stone crabs, logically enough.
Sounds good to me. Did you have a question for Deanne?
Yes, Deanne, Yes. Why would you choose to write a book about Joe's stone crab when you're a vegetarian and don't eat crabs?
That was supposed to be a secret. There is no other place that I've been to eat that's like Joe's. It's the place where everybody wants to go to celebrate.
Well, the sides,
to be
too.
A part of. And is in terms of the food, there's nothing like everything from start to finish, from the salad to the key lime pie is very special.
Okay. Well, Deanne, your book, Joe's Waiting at Joe's, of course, it's a play on the word waiting. What's going on with the waiting there, the staff?
Well, actually, the code name was always going to be Waiting at Joe's, the story about the waiters and not the wait, and the publisher thought that was too long, but that's really what the essence is. They do not take reservations at Joe's. They never have. I don't think they ever will, and Steve will confirm that, I'm sure.
Steve is sitting here smiling, right?
But because they don't take reservations, it's part of the game. It's part of what you do is you stand by and you wait and have a drink, and you can sit in the courtyard, you can have hors d'oeuvres or whatever, and it's a lovely experience. But this is not the story about the wait. This is the story about the waiters.
Well, and so many of them been there for, 30 and 40 years, Stephen?
Many of them have, yes. We've had some since, 1968.
And their children are now working there.
Oh, yes. In some cases, grandchildren.
Amazing, amazing. Well, I want to ask you about this thing called roll call. That is, we have annual interviews for the wait staff. It's famous. Tell us about it.
Well, I think Steve could probably tell more than I can, but the interesting thing that I found about roll call is that it is open to anybody. It's men and women. It's all sizes and shapes, and you have to have a certain dexterity in order to make roll call.
Yes. Well, roll call has been going on since I was little, so probably even before then. And what we do is, since we're closed every single summer, we want to know when we're reopening who's coming back to the restaurant, so that when we open in mid-October, we have a roll call to see who's coming back. And then we also inform the wait staff and the kitchen staff, etc., what the new policies are, who came back, what the insurance issues are, and profit sharing issues and things like that. We want to it's a great time to have a homecoming, so to speak, where everybody, feels good, and then we have speeches, and we have, professionals come in and give the staff the status of their accounts and what the new health insurance laws are and what the benefits that we're providing. We really have to do
but
that.
In addition to that, isn't that the time when new people are trying to become waiters?
Well, then there's another roll call soon after that, and that's when the new people come in. They line up outside in the alley, typically, and one by one they fill out their forms, and then they, you know, a lot of them are dressed up really nice, etc. But they sit in the main dining room, and we have coffee and danishes for them, and then after that they, you know, one by one we call each person individually, and we have a staff of people who are, you know, our wait staff, seating captains and maitre d's, who interview one by one those people. And there's a tray carrying thing too.
I was going to say there's a special test.
Right.
Dini, did you want to tell us about
that? Yeah, to me that's the fun part of it. Yes, they are interviewed as
it can be fun.
Well, but it basically shows you who can and who can't, and
right.
Even the strongest guys, from what I've been told, sometimes cannot. Hold it the right way,
and she's holding it.
You've got to be held in one hand.
Some of the strongest women can't either.
I know.
It's amazing.
Well, this is not television. This is radio. So we have to explain where your hand is.
Basically, if you hold your hand out, when they come out of the kitchen.
And they're holding it up.
They're holding it
on
up
their
high,
shoulder.
And it's
and
very
balancing.
Heavy.
And they're balancing hot things and sharp things.
And heavy
too.
Things. Heavy crabs.
Oh, yeah.
The crabs are heavy.
So they have to be able to carry this heavy, heavy tray.
And that's part of what they have to pass during roll call.
So what are the other things, other than having to carry the tray, what are the other characteristics that you look for?
Well, I can answer that.
Okay.
Well, I think their work experience is very important. And how long they've worked at different places, and the level of service that the servers have provided. The other thing is, you know, okay, tell us, you know, not just the standard questions. Tell us about yourself. I want to know a little bit more than just where did you work and how long did you work there. Sometimes you throw in oddball questions here and there just to catch them, to see how they speak, their diction, their appearance. Those are very important things. And if they smile. I mean, that's, you know, that's part of the deal.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we just said that it's your 100th anniversary, and congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
It's an amazing feat in this restaurant world. So many restaurants are gone before they're open, practically.
It's true.
The history of Joe's can be sort of compared to the history of Miami. Can you give us some of these examples?
Well, Miami has had a very colorful history, and not a long history, but if you go back to like the 1910s, 20, you know, 10s and 20s, Miami Beach was a haven and a neutral place for all the gangsters from all over, like Chicago, New York, et cetera, Philadelphia, and the gangsters used to come and R&R on Miami Beach, and so we were neutral. There was no infight, there was no fighting, there were no, you know,
they
gun
had
wars.
Leave their guns at the door? I mean,
pretty
the neutral
much.
Area.
Maybe. I don't know what the laws were back then, but I know that Al Capone
was there,
and a lot of colorful people, the Meyer Lansky's, which was a little bit later on, and you know, the interesting J. Edgar Hoover also came to Joe's at the same time.
I think what's really interesting is that, you know, that era, you know, of the mafia, of the FBI being in Joe's the same night, of the president being in one corner, of the history has to do with equal rights and women's rights and homosexuality and the cocaine wars and drug wars and celebrities and trysts and everything. And that's the history of the beach, of the world, and of the, you know, of everybody really in growing up over the past 100 years.
Right.
And Joe's has lived through all that.
Watergate too.
Yeah, Watergate too. Yeah.
Amazing, amazing. Well, we have to get back to this thing that we've been gorging ourselves. And I do admit it. On these wonderful stone crabs and all. And let's talk a little bit about this. You have something here besides stone crabs on this tray.
Yes.
What is it?
Okay. I brought the Alaskan king crab.
Claws. They're so sweet. They're big, beautiful ones.
Right. We've been using those, and we had them on the menu. We put them on, I think Brian found them about 5 years ago and during another shortage. And we wanted to have something, a great alternative that you could serve hot or cold, that goes with the mustard, that's fairly easy to and available to get. So
there is a shortage now of stone crabs, is what you're
it
saying?
It seems, it appears to be. And the price reflects that, but also the catch reflects that.
And what's causing that?
you know, that what we believe is that the octopus had a lot to do with it. But this past week, we've had such great, I mean, heavy duty weather, which with lots of winds and stuff, and it's churning up the water. And we have a new moon right now, so it's not as bright in the water. So we think, and I've seen the production tick up a little bit. So every little bit counts. And so, it looks like North Florida is even picking up a little bit.
Great. And now you mentioned that mustard sauce. So tell us, what's in the mustard sauce?
Well, these are all really healthy things. Like, okay, I'll start with
the mayonnaise.
Let's start with the mayonnaise.
Or is it the cream you want to start with?
Well, you hit two of the healthiest things I can think of. We have 3.5 teaspoons of Coleman's dry English mustard. That's one of the ingredients. Mayonnaise, Worcestershire sauce, like 2 teaspoons of that. 1 teaspoon of A1 steak sauce and maybe salt to taste, and then 2 tablespoons of light cream. But it's on the, you can find it on the web.
Right, and I'm going to put it on dinnerinminutes.com.
And that's enough for about 4 people, right?
Yes,
right.
for four people. Okay. Sure. We make it by the gazillions of gallons at a time.
You sure do. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and my guests today are Stephen Sawitz, COO of Joe Stonecrab, and Dini Kaplan-Lorber, author of Waiting at Joe's. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guests today are Stephen Sawitz, Joe Stonecrab's Chief Operating Officer and great-grandson of the founder, Joe Weiss, and Dini Kaplan-Lorber, author of Waiting at Joe's. They've been giving us a very interesting inside look at this Florida legend as the restaurant celebrates its 100th anniversary. Well, it's dinner in minutes time, so I thought for dinner in minutes, we'd stick with the shellfish. And we're going to make some Key West shrimp and tropical tropical coleslaw. Now, for those you may not know, the Key West shrimp are really plump and juicy, but they're pink before they're cooked. So that's how you'll know you're getting the real one. And for this recipe, I've just cooked them in beer, Key West style. So you just put them in their shells. You bring the beer in a saucepan, bring it to a boil, add the shrimp, and as soon as the beer comes back to the boil, take it off the heat. Remove the shrimp and then just lay out a layer of newspaper, put it on the table, and let everybody dig in, just like they do in Key West. And I have a sauce, a mayonnaise sauce, which is mayonnaise, mustard, and key lime juice. But maybe we could use your sauce now that we know what it is, Stephen Sawitz.
It's for sale.
It's for sale?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I always thought that was a secret recipe. Now you're telling us how many ingredients are in it.
It's only secret to us, Fred.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, right. Oh, it's a breeze to make homemade coleslaw these days because you can buy the cabbage already shredded. You mix in the supermarket. I added some mayonnaise and just a little vinegar to make it. And or if you're in a real, real hurry, dinner in minutes, buy coleslaw and add some pineapple cubes to it to make a tropical slaw. Well, that complete recipe is at dinnerinminutes.com. And another very quick and easy dinner is herb-crusted grouper with hot, spicy brown rice. That's in today's Miami Herald. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, let's drink.
Well, first I want to say hi to Stephen. It's been a long time. Nice talking to you.
Likewise, Fred. I didn't realize that you were gone. You were away from us.
Well, it's 40 degrees here and spitting snow, so we're having a good time.
He loves that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do love it.
You're a good guy.
Anyway, good old Joe's Stonecrab. The start of the season always brings back fond memories for me. One thing I remember is that for years, my good friend Bob Hossman, kind of a Renaissance guy who's written food reviews and wine columns for the Miami Herald and the Sun Sentinel and a lot of other papers, used to host a lunch at Joe's, and we would try several different wine matches with the Stonecrab to see which went best. And I guess the overall winner was Robert Mondavi's Fumé Blanc, which is a California Sauvignon Blanc white wine that's aged in oak barrels. That's why they call it Fumé Blanc. And it had nice, crisp citrus flavors, but they were made richer by the oak aging, so it was really a nice match. But I also remember the time a winemaker hosted a similar tasting at Joe's in which we tried a red wine, a French Beaujolais Nouveau with the stone crabs. And I guess I should say, in my humble opinion, that was one of the worst wine food pairings I ever had.
I can't imagine that with stone crabs.
Yeah.
It was just too red and too sweet and that sort of thing. Anyway, of course, when you're doing fine wine food pairings, you also have to consider the sauce that goes with the food. And at Joe's, of course, you have the two main choices, melted butter, which goes nicely with a big buttery California Chardonnay, and Joe's, I guess, no longer secret, if it ever was, mustard sauce, which went better with the sort of citrusy Fumé Blanc. But today, I think there would be a lot of other choices as new wines become popular. The wine from Argentina called, the white wine called Torontés, which is has spicy lychee flavors, is a great match for crabs with that mustard sauce. Or a French Muscadet, which is light and tangy and very dry, is also a nice pairing for the stone crabs. And, of course, when you come to the famous key lime pie for dessert, I'd pour a kind of sweet, tart, white Gewürztraminer dessert wine with that.
Well, Fred Tasker, you just led me right into my next question. Key lime pie. We've been eating this key lime pie here, and it is so good. It's very, very cold. I mean, do you keep them frozen at the restaurant?
We actually do. After they're baked, we put them, you know, we let them air cool a little bit, and then we put them in the freezer. And then before they're served, we let them come down a little bit, which is, you know, to get a little heat so that it's softer.
All right. So you gave us the secret recipe for the mustard. Now you're online here for the key lime pie.
This is going to be tough. Okay. The ingredients for the key lime pie, we have a graham cracker crust that has pieces and crumbs of the graham crackers and butter and sugar.
It's a nice thick crust.
Fairly thick, mm-hmm. Yes. It is, yeah. And it's made by hand by the same person in the key lime pie room day after day. I mean, Bob is the one that does that, Robert.
Boy, you must get tired of key lime pies if that's all he does.
You know, but I'm not tired of the smell. My office is right next door, so it smells great. And then the filling, the filling doesn't smell as great as
the graham crackers and the sugar.
It smells so good. But the other ingredients are the key lime juice, obviously, the egg yolks, and the sweetened condensed milk. And there's two bakings. You cook the crust first, doesn't take too long, and then you pour the mixture into that and bake that for a while.
There was a story that reminds me of where Stephen can actually make the pies for the restaurant if he had to. There was a gentleman, Stephen, who was doing the key lime pie for years.
Right, that was Polly Wilson Sr. He was making them for...
What a wonderful career.
That's all he
yeah.
did.
Well, yeah, it's from starting from 6 in yeah. the morning till the wee hours. And during one of his breaks, he took a break because he worked till almost midnight. While napping on the cot, he passed away. And he'd started Joe's in 1956. Mm-hmm. And this was in 1995. And he'd been making the pies since 1968.
And no one else knew how to make them.
Well, Mom did. It was her recipe, but she was on a cruise.
So what impressed me, I have to interrupt you there, because what impressed me, and this is what's very cool about Stephen, is that he somehow calculated how many pies were needed to feed the customers at Joe's for lunch and for dinner until his mom came back, because and until somebody could be found to replace Paul to make the pies so that there would be enough. And if there were not enough, he would have started making them himself.
Oh, sure. Sure.
So in other words, he had enough in the freezer to know. So you know how many pies you're going to serve at the restaurant?
We keep track of all the items that we sell. So we knew how many pieces per day. And this was in February during the boat show, which is not when you want to run out anyway.
Oh my goodness.
It was mid-February and it was like around the 12th or 13th of right around Valentine's Day too. And Mom was due back in like a little over a day, like 2 days. And we had just enough. And in fact, the very first thing I said to her, I was waiting for her at her condo, was, I got some bad news.
Oh, she didn't know.
She didn't know about
right.
Polly, yeah.
Right. And it just seems to me that everyone is your family who work there.
Right.
You feel for every single one.
Especially Polly.
On an average night, how many pounds of stone crabs do you go through?
Well, among the sizes, we do serve at least four sizes. A little over 1,000 pounds in the restaurant. And then you have to include takeaway
right.
and shipping.
And about how many people do you serve a night?
Close to 1,200, 1,300, somewhere in there.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's really been a very, very, very tasty week.
Indeed.
We've all loved it. Stephen Sawitz, thank you so much for joining us and for that special food from Joe's. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And congratulations once more on Joe's 100th anniversary. Deanie Kaplan-Lorber, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Great to have you with
us. Thank you so much.
Her book is Waiting at Joe's, and it's a charming look at the inner workings of Joe Stonecrab. And I think it's available everywhere, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Everywhere.
Everywhere and at Joe's, I suppose.
And at Joe's, of course.
So very right. Well, next week we'll be talking about the invention of the American meal with the author of the book Three Squares, Abigail Carroll. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical supervision by Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and other programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. We return Monday with a 23-year Army veteran and professor who's written Breach of Trust, which addresses today's U.S. military. And the calendar, excuse me, on this day in 1805, 208 years ago, the Lewis and Clark expedition reaches the Pacific Ocean near what is now Astoria, Oregon. They return to St. Louis via the Missouri in September of 1806. And on this day in 1900, 113 years ago, the birth of Nazi SS and Gestapo leader Heinrich Himmler near Munich. Before joining the Nazis, he was a chicken farmer. And one more while we assume he inhaled. On this day in 1987, 26 years ago, appellate judge Douglas H. Ginsburg asks President Reagan to withdraw his nomination to the Supreme Court after a clamor ensued when it was revealed he was an occasional pot smoker in the 60s and 70s. Today's recipe, dinnerinminutes.com. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. We leave with a thought from Himmler, who swallowed cyanide before testifying at Nuremberg. Quote, "The best political weapon is the weapon of terror. Cruelty commands respect. Men may hate us, but we don't ask for love, only for their fear." Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay with us. Next up, it's Here and Now from NPR News.